Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk welcoming you to Valley Writers Read, where we've got two stories for you tonight, both of them about remembrances of the past. The first one is by Clovis author Deb Barofka, and she entitles it With Me Still. And then we have another memoir, this one by Janice Stevens, entitled Dust to Dust. But first things first, here's Debbie to start us off.
With Me Still. After the birth of our first daughter, I found myself swept into the realm of frilly doll dresses. Baby clothes were a sheer delight. Maybe it was hormones. I don't know. But after the nausea, the heartburn, the insomnia of pregnancy, my body was overjoyed to return to its former shape and size. I switched from shopping for maternity clothes, designed to flatter my own expansion, to sizes now labeled things like 0 to 3 months, 3 to 6 months, 2T, and 3T. From yards of fabric to dainty swatches, the pastel colors, the soft brush cotton, the tiny buttons and buttonholes, I love them all, especially the dresses. Dresses with crisp pinafores, eyelet hems, appliques of tiny flowers with trailing embroidered stems and leaves. Nothing prepares you for how quickly a baby grows into a toddler and a toddler into a preschooler. Every change in season for the first few years of Katie's life was heralded by yet another new outfit. It seemed I was forever buying new clothes as her sizes increased season by season and year by year. There were patterned Oshkosh overalls with matching shirts, sundresses, Christmas dresses, dresses for Valentine's Day. Easter was coming, and on this particular day, I was on the hunt for this year's spring dress, maybe one with an apron. Our daughter would soon be three, and so far she loved dressing up in all the silly frills and shiny Mary Janes I had collected and carefully arranged in her closet. A children's boutique had recently opened in the same shopping area as our grocery store. Over the door, a dark wood sign was carved with a long-legged bird who carried a diapered bundle suspended from his beak. It read, "The Velvet Stork," in raised gold script. The windows displayed impossibly cute clothing, play overalls, matching socks and hats, baby layette and coordinating prints. My favorite area was in the front where all these tiny dresses with labels like Storybook and Feldman Brothers hung on round racks. I especially looked for dresses with smocking, hand-sewn details made from tiny gathered pleats and precise embroidery. I fingered miniature collars, admired hand-done hems, inhaled the scent of talcum-scented shelf paper that permeated the store. It was a gossamer cocoon of a place, one where every child was an opportunity to celebrate with matching booties and favorite storybooks. This particular Saturday morning was sunny, the outdoor temperature already on the rise. The Central Valley usually has mild springs, saving the real heat for mid-June through October. I riffled through a rack of new spring dresses near the counter. The sales clerk spoke. "It's starting to heat up out there, isn't it?" "Yeah, I'm afraid so. It'll probably be in the 80s before the day is over. We've been here for 12 years, and I'm still not used to this god-awful summer heat." She laughed. "Us either. We're from Oregon. It never gets past 90 in the Willamette Valley, that's for sure." "Willamette Valley? No kidding. I was born in Oregon City. Half of our 4th of July picnics were beneath rain shelters in McIver Park." She put her paperwork down and looked at me. "My kids went to Molalla High School." I yelped at the coincidence. My small-town mentality, the one that just expected to see someone I'd know if I was out and about, shook itself awake. My husband teased me about this when we were first married. It seemed as if no matter where we went, even if it were in a state half across the country, I would see someone I knew. I had a vague idea that this had something to do with being raised in such a small community in the first place, as if just expecting these social coincidences was the reason, if not the magic, behind such odd happenstances. Over time, though, these episodes happened less and less, especially since we'd moved here to Fresno, far from the backwoods of Clackamas County. But now, a torrent of small-town synchronicities poured out, as if to make up for the dry spell of the past few years, and my husband wasn't even there to witness it. I knew he'd never believe me. I went to Mallala High. We lived in Clark's, and my dad grew up in Colton. Oh my gosh, Colton? That's near our old house. In fact, we still haven't sold it. It's just down the road from Ruraldale Elementary School. Do you know that area? I have been gone for over half my life by now, but at the mere mention of the common geography, the images of the country roads with their weathered fence posts and overgrown pastures unfolded in my mind's eye. The roads curved, farmland meeting the eye wherever there was a break between the fir trees. The farther you drove, the farther apart the houses grew, the more broken fences, rusted cars, and tractors appeared. Life was hard there. The land offered her green self, but by the time a family made ends meet for the week, they were hard-pressed to see the beauty. They were just too tired. By the time I was in high school, I knew I could never stay. I think my granddad still lives over that way. His mailing address is in Ruraldale. I can't believe I'm talking to someone who even knows these places. The woman took off her glasses. What's his name? You know what a small place it is. Maybe I know him. Clifford Everson. He was a carpenter, but now he's retired. He farms sheep. Clifford is your granddad? His house is just behind our property. My girls used to walk down that gravel road after school, and Grandma Stella always had cookies and milk for them. Becky was just brokenhearted when she died so suddenly that Christmas. I was aware of an ache in the center of my chest, a deep, dull throb down the length of my sternum. It was in my bones. I can remember the smell of cookies baking, the ironing board always in a fixed position somewhere in the corner of the kitchen, an old plastic laundry basket with piles of clothing spilling over the edges sat below. My grandmother was always a bustle of activity. If she wasn't baking, she was ironing, or sewing yet another piece of clothing on the singer in the corner of the living room. She often wore an apron, but always wore a dress, usually something with tiny flowers. She smelled like bread rising and sometimes lavender. I was the first grandchild, only slightly tainted in my place of honor by virtue of being the child of her most difficult son. But all of this I came to know much later, after the divorce of my parents and the distance of many years. In my earliest memory, she is always there, and her attentions made me feel special, that she knew I had been born with gifts. I visited Grandma when my parents had errands. My favorite spot was the kitchen. The smell of coffee perking offered a kind of calm, which had steadily decreased in my family with the birth of each of my siblings. My mother was always tired, juggling a job in Oregon City, tending to us five kids, and running whatever errands my father needed on weekends. Usually his Saturday demands involved getting auto parts and tires from Estacada to supply the gas station where he worked. If I was lucky, that meant an afternoon at Grandma and Grandpa's house in Colton. I perched on a chrome and plastic dinette chair under the window. It was a perfect spot to draw in color, my two favorite pastimes when I was six. Grandma had an old shoebox full of all sorts of odds and ends of crayons, colored pencil stubs, and ink pens. I loved inhaling the waxy smell and reading the strange names of colors from their torn paper covers under my breath. Ochre, umber, chartreuse, orchid, evergreen, yellow-orange, and my favorite, sky blue. I noticed the longer the wrapper, the uglier the color. The primary colors were mostly unwrapped stubs, nicked and some only as long as my thumb, but still good enough for making pictures. Grandma was taking clothing from the ironing basket. She used an old green Coke bottle filled with tap water to sprinkle the individual shirts and pants. It was my job to fill the bottle at the kitchen tap when it ran dry and there were more clothes to initiate for her ritual of ironing. She worked methodically, sprinkling each shirt, then rolling it up in a neat sausage, stacking it at the end of the ironing board. By the time she was finished, there was a pile of multicolored rolls stacked as neatly as cordwood. She dabbed at her forehead with the bottom of her apron. I think I'll have a cup of coffee. Would you like some Kool-Aid? She pulled out the chair next to me and sat down. I drank from a tall aluminum tumbler. It gave the Kool-Aid a faintly metallic taste I loved. She looked at my pictures. A barn, a tree, a pasture scene. Ah, you're such a smart one. Look at how you drew the barn in the distance, just like it looks, smaller and not as clear as the fence in the front. She was an appreciative audience. Grandma, could you draw something for me? My picture isn't right. I don't know what to put here, on this side. I pointed, bored and a little sleepy. I don't know. But she picked up a stub of a yellow pencil, and she began to sketch. I was intrigued. She made dark, bold lines and followed them with shorter strokes. She filled in lines and shaded more. Her eyes were intent on the paper, but she seemed far away. She looked at something I couldn't see. The pencil scratched and flew. Minutes passed. I was transfixed. She put down the pencil. Her drawing was filled with subtleties I had not yet seen emerge from that old shoebox. There on my paper, in front of my flat line drawings of a distant barn and tree, was a horse, sinewy and motionless, but ready to break into a run at any moment, rendered in pencil before my eyes. Where had it come from? How did she summon it from that bitten stub of a pencil? I looked at my grandmother. She seemed her ordinary self. She had emptied her coffee cup, rinsed it, and set it on the stove. Back at the ironing board, she was humming a tune I didn't recognize. At that moment, I was aware that people carried their own magic, magic that you might not see on the outside, but inside, like a flicker of a candle or a firefly, it was there. My grandmother had more stories than I knew, and even more than that, she had secrets. She tested the iron by licking her middle finger and tapping the surface of the iron. It sizzled, an indication it was perfectly heated. She rolled out the first shirt and began with the collar. The next step in the Saturday ritual of ironing had commenced. The smell of steamy cotton filled the air and mingled with the coffee. They blended with the smell of my crayons and pencil lead, and together they wove a spell of scent, hypnotic and lazy, which left me slumped over my picture, the wild horse there before me, inviting me to dream. During other visits, we would bake, usually sugar cookies, in the midst of all her other domestic chores. I loved pinching taste of the sweet, stiff dough and choosing the cookie cutters from the heap on the counter. Grandma's cookie cutters were large aluminum ones, each one a little bent and dull, but still serviceable. My favorites were the gingerbread man and girl. He had a triangle-shaped hat and mitten-shaped hands, while she had a triangle skirt and corkscrew hair imprinted in the aluminum. Grandma rolled out the dough on the breadboard, and small heaps of flour beneath the dough made an occasional puff as she worked. There were faint smudges of flour on her cheeks from pushing up her glasses with the back of her wrist. I cut the cookie dough, pressing the shapes into the surface and ending with a muffled click as it hit the wood below. Spilling the little silver candy beads from the decorator's jar and pushing them down into the dough to make faces and the illusion of shirts and skirts was the next step. "You're getting good at this." Her voice was high, and there was a Minnesota rhythm to her words. Dipping her hand into the sugar bin and sprinkling white sugar lightly, she offered a sweet blessing before they went to the oven. Soon the air warmed and filled with the scent of buttery vanilla, comfortable, familiar. The cookies cooled on the counter. It was always a surprise the way they came out golden brown while the silver bead stayed shiny and the sprinkled sugar still white. My grandmother shooed me out of the kitchen until she deemed them cool enough to enjoy with a glass of milk or Kool-Aid. Now here I was, standing in the middle of a children's clothing store over 700 miles away, talking to her farm neighbors. These things don't happen. And yet, here they were, flesh and blood people, whose name was Slevkov, telling me stories about my grandmother. Here was that old ache, the one that came with the memories of the warm kitchen, the old gray formica table, sugar cookies and black coffee. In the aftermath of the divorce, I lost my father. but I also lost my grandmother, grandfather, uncles, aunts, cousins, summers, holidays, and afternoons in my grandmother's kitchen, the conversations, hearing her voice tell her own stories. All these were lost to me after my fifth grade year. Instead of me, she had given these gifts of herself to others, others who now also carried memories of her kitchen. I felt a twin rush of jealousy and grief for what was, what wasn't, and what could never be. In the years that followed, I wondered if the Eversons missed me as much as I missed them. As each year passed, we had no contact, and I began to conclude that they didn't. My father went on to marry a hairstylist only 11 years older than myself, and my connection to my father's family began to break apart, fade, wafting away like smoke from a fire. I didn't see my grandmother again until the day I married. All of the Eversons arrived. All but my father, that is. Despite my invitation, he decided it best not to upset my mother. I was determined to walk down that church aisle by myself, whether he came or not. I did. It was fine. I wore daisies in my hair and carried yellow roses. During the reception afterwards, I spoke to each of my aunts and uncles, to my grandmother and grandfather. They stood in their own little group, somewhat awkward among so many unfamiliar faces. They were reserved, but at that time I hadn't really come to understand that Norwegians are not an emotionally demonstrative people, and that even though I might look like them, inside, my wiring was different. My grandmother spoke first. It was a beautiful wedding. We enjoyed the music especially, didn't we, Clifford? She nodded to my grandfather. I was taller than he was in my heels. They all seemed so much smaller than I remembered them. We did. It was a beautiful service. He spoke softly, looking down at the floor. He looked uncomfortable in his dark sports jacket and plaid shirt. I knew these were his best clothes, that everyday life saw him in overalls and work shirts worn thin around the neck. Grandmother continued, "So when will you be coming out to see us? We'd love a visit before you're off to school again." She was very polite and carefully superficial, testing the waters to see if anything at all, remained of the girl she once knew, the one that baked cookies, drew pictures, and learned to embroider in her kitchen. I smiled and assured them we would be out before the summer's end. They all broke into relieved smiles. "Oh, that'll be just fine. We'll fix a potluck. Maybe we can invite your brothers and sisters. We have so much to catch up on." Grandma beamed. The warmth of her attention streamed over my face, and I could feel them trickle into the empty spaces in my heart. Another guest touched my arm to offer congratulations. By the time I finished that conversation and greeting the next group of well-wishers, I saw the Everson knot clustered at the door. Grandma had my husband's elbow and was speaking emphatically. Though he was nodding amiably, his body was stiff. Something was up. Later, I asked about the conversation. "Your grandmother was intense. Make sure you bring her out to see us. Just make sure. She acted like it was my fault she hadn't seen you all these years. I don't even know her, and she was in my face. I'll be glad when we get out of here in August. Families. Ugh." We did go out to visit. We ate some kind of noodle casserole Grandma called hot dish, along with cherry jello and fruit cocktail, white rolls and apple pie, and lots of strong black coffee. We attempted to make up for lost years. I realized they were hurt people, not larger-than-life figures as they had been once when I was a child, but ordinary people wounded by their own acts as much as by the acts of others. It was too difficult to tell them the stories of my life in the years we'd been apart. It would only bring pain for things they couldn't undo. They were getting older and more frail, and I couldn't see any good coming from telling them the ills that followed in the aftermath of the divorce. I was just grateful for the chance to reconnect, to see my own face and those around me for the first time in many years. After we moved out of state, we received monthly letters from my grandmother detailing her garden's progress, summer plans, my grandfather's latest carpentry projects. Those letters were both a comfort and a regret. A comfort for being remembered, a regret for all we couldn't say. My letters back to her mirrored like content, carefully avoiding suggestion of any real emotion, just relaying matter-of-fact communication about how graduate school was progressing for the two of us. This pattern of exchange continued until her death in December, 2 years later. She and my grandfather had gone into town so she could find a Christmas dress, but they were unsuccessful. As she was getting ready for bed that night, her heart gave out. My grandfather called 911, but the ambulance didn't arrive in time to be of any help. Their home was in a very rural spot and at the end of a long gravel driveway. She was gone. My grandfather was devastated. The family went numb. She was younger than he was and still had smooth cheeks, eyes that sparkled. Advancing age had not seemed an enemy, not yet. There were so many questions I could never ask her now. Her heart had been broken so many times and in so many ways. I wish I had heard from her own mouth how she coped. I would be left with her visits in my dreams. In the meantime, I had taken my first job postgraduate school. I wasn't able to make the trip to Oregon for the funeral. It felt like a betrayal. But I was already overwhelmed with new work responsibilities, long hours, and the realities of married life. I sent the biggest bouquet of flowers I could afford. My younger sister later told me that the local florist, whose flower supply was depleted from all the Christmas orders of the previous week, had sent a huge basket of blood-red anthurium, shocking the women from the Lord of Life Lutheran. The whole arrangement, with its shiny red, heart-shaped petals and long white stamens, was just a little too phallic for most of those sturdy folk, especially at a respectable woman's funeral. I was at a loss for what to do. I hadn't attended, and the flowers I sent created a stir for the wrong reasons. Twice aired. I was embarrassed to even apologize to my grandfather, and in the end, I let the stoic Norwegian approach suffice. What was done was done. I emerged from the Velvet Stork hours later after hearing as many stories as Mrs. Slevkoff and her daughter could tell me. I sat in the car, lost in thought. I started to put the key in the ignition, staring into the rearview mirror for a long time, into the hall of mirrors of memory. I could see reflections inside of reflections inside of reflections, stories inside of stories inside of stories. Some of the mirrors were cracked and broken. Some of the images were distorted and dizzy-making. Images of my grandmother, of her as a young woman, as my father's mother, as a wife, a homemaker, swirled with images of my daughter's face in the silvery surface, until gradually my own face came into focus. I could feel the heat of the day shimmering all around me. Behind my eyes, beyond the blueness, deep in my soul, I knew she was with me still.
Friends, that was Deb Borofka reading With Me Still. And so here we meet a young mother out shopping, and what do you know? She accidentally meets another shopper, Mrs. Slevkoff, who hails from the same town in Oregon as the young mom. What a coincidence. Mrs. Slevkoff even remembers going to some of the same schools as she did, even remembers her grandfather. It all brings back so many memories, especially of her grandmother, with whom she spent so much time years ago. But then came that painful divorce, which for so many years broke off so much. And although both she and her grandmother tried to reconcile, things were never the same again. And because she's now remarried with a difficult job and busy raising her children, she's unable to attend her grandmother's funeral up in Oregon. And now to our second story. It's entitled Dust to Dust. And here to read it for us is the author, Janice Stevens. Dust to Dust.
Dust to Dust by Janice Stevens. Transplanted from North Dakota to California at the age of 4, I am compelled to return to the land of my birth. I talk by phone to my Aunt Laura, one of 2 siblings alive of the 6 children on my mother's side. My plane doesn't get in until 11:30 p.m., I say. I'll just take a taxi. I don't bother asking her not to stay up because I know I can't deter the Midwest hospitality awaiting me. I will have her bedroom and bath. She will sleep on the hide-a-bed. It's just the way it is, and my persuading falls on unreceptive ears. I know before I leave to return to Fresno, she will host a dinner buffet, and my cousins and their families, driving from their farms, will all gather in to welcome me. The next day, we rise early to make the 150-mile drive from her home of Grand Forks to each of my cousins' farms. I am lost in the tapestry of the landscape as we drive northwest. Miles and miles of swaying wheat remind me of the lyrics in America the Beautiful, a description appropriate to the amber waves of grain so abundant in North Dakota. The wheat in hues of magenta and ochre contrasts with the wind barrier of hunter green trees outlining the expanse of grain. I am mesmerized by the abstract patterns and geometric designs that draw my eye to a horizon line that meets a clear blue sky, spotted with cumulus clouds that cast curvilinear shapes across the flat, mostly unbroken terrain. Wind barrier strips seem to outline the patterns, separating ownership and crops. Occasionally, the dark brown dirt of a fallow land, quiet now for a rejuvenating season, punctuates the colorful patchwork of the landscape. The rich soil of the plains connects me to a time and place I hold in memory. I am root-bound in Calvin, North Dakota, about a mile from the Canadian border, 75 miles from my birthplace of Langdon, the land of my forefathers. If I gaze north, in the dusk, the light from the aurora borealis illuminates the horizon line and mingles with the twinkling lights from our northern neighbor. Calvin, in its heyday, boasted thriving businesses, an active civic center, and schools renowned for values of decency and integrity, as well as curricula. The First Baptist Church, with its steeple intact, reminds me of my father singing, "Bless this house, O Lord, I pray, keep it safe both night and day." Adjacent to my parents' farm, the Masonic Lodge stands with chip paint and padlocked doors, no longer host to community and philanthropic activities. The membership card belonging to my father, a 32nd degree Mason, Scottish Rites, is in my scrapbook. Generations of McKechnies, my maiden name, and Duncans, my maternal grandparents, once clustered in this northwest section of North Dakota. Their names linger in archival records of schools, churches, and clubs. Less than a half mile from the farm, the Calvin Corinthian Cemetery is barely visible from the road. It is here, buried in knee-high weeds with a blustery wind on us, that I kneel to brush the dust from the crevices of the lettering on the McKechnie tombstone. Other names remind me of the Scots heritage in my veins, those of McLean's, McLeod's, and McDonald's, Ferguson, Morgan, and Crawford, many related familiar names on my genealogical pedigree chart. My McKechnie great-grandfather's farm is no longer in the family name, sold by my father when we moved to California. Yet my cousin's kitchen window frames the scene today. Although the farmhouse was demolished years ago, a lone chimney, fireplace, and hearth remain of my first home. A large farming corporation now leases the farm. In my mind, I place the pictures from my family albums on the image of the land. The white, two-story farmhouse with a basement for storage and shelter from the ever-present danger of tornadoes and cyclones. The picture of Uncle Mac and my father standing in the field, their beaming smiles and the height of the wheat tell me it was a good year. Dependent on the whims of Mother Nature, the crops are successful, or they fail based on the area rainfall. Irrigation is not possible in this arid land too far removed from a water source such as the Red River or Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes. In my father's picture, I see a horse and tiller guided by a hired hand. I remember my grandparents' stories of harvesting the crops. Sometimes the farmers would work together, and always the hired hands were needed during that timely and crucial period. My grandmother often spoke of the full dinners served at noon as she, my mother, and her domestics prepared full-course meals to transport by horse and buggy to the field to feed the men. At night, a light supper greeted them at the end of the day. Today, my cousins have large semi-trucks and state-of-the-art combines. They are able to farm North Dakota's premier export, durum wheat, as well as canola and blue flax without additional hired hands. But they, too, are a dying breed, even with equipment so much more sophisticated than that of my parents and grandparents. They now see neighbors leaving the land, selling out to corporations, and they know, too, that aging might require their own abandonment. The towns disappear, the schools close. Aunt Laura says, North Dakota's richest asset is her children, and they are all leaving. In the town of Calvin, my cousin Merritt's wife taught high school. This is the same school, albeit not the same building, that my father was the principal. This year's class consisted of 4 seniors, 3 juniors, and 2 sophomores. Next year, the Calvin students and other students from the small border communities of Sorrels and Hanna will bus 2.5 hours one way to attend a school and perhaps travel as far as Devil's Lake, where my mother graduated from college. My cousins are the last of the 6 generations to farm this land dating back to the mid-1800s. Theirs is the land the Duncans farmed. The farmhouse has been replaced, but another section close by, the Larson cousins farmed the land that belonged to Aunt Laura and Uncle Urban Larson. The farmhouse is structurally the same farmhouse my cousins grew up in. During their childhood, my aunt and uncle lived in town, in Bismarck, during the winter. Today, my cousins return to Grand Forks for the winter. Although the 100-year Red River flood of 1997 destroyed their town home, they chose to rebuild rather than challenge the severity of North Dakota winters on the farm. We leave my cousin's home in Calvin and head closer to the border. I catch another cemetery in my peripheral vision, this one perhaps even older than the Calvin Corinthian Cemetery. A few upright marble tombstones rise above the crude but clean grounds. The iron picket fence encloses the area with the entrance through a gate, not so sturdy as when first constructed. An inscription above the gate says Byron Cemetery, and it is here I find my Irish heritage. Loving hands have cleared the weeds from tombstones still standing erect. The constant wind dies down enough for me to take a tombstone rubbing. I place the vellum over the marble tombstone of Higgins, their predominant ancestor, and my maternal great-grandmother's ancestry. I wrap the vellum around the stone and pull the chalk across the face. I watch the names and dates emerge onto the fabric. William Higgins, born 1st of February, 1840, died 21st April, 1914. Jeanette Douglas Higgins, born 5 May 1842, died 19 November 1912. The gusts of wind whip the fabric from my hands, and I'm unable to get a crisp image of other Irish ancestors. I photograph the other graves and tombstones. I am humbled in the face of history, suggested in the dates when North Dakota was a portion of the Louisiana Purchase, later to become Dakota Territory, then the state of North Dakota. I read the lettering and remember the struggle for survival these Scottish, Irish, and Canadian immigrants endured, who existed inside houses and who swept their dirt floors clean with handmade brooms of straw. Before the immigration to the United States, the Irish ancestors fled Ireland to Canada during the potato famine to seek a better life. I'm ashamed, my cousin Larry says, as he walks around the graves with me. I question his comment, and he says, "You come all the way out here to find these graves, and I drive by every day and never stop." Perhaps the reason for my yearning to be here, to walk this land, to feel the dust slip between my fingers, is because I don't drive by every day, I say. I return again and again to see earth-tone patterns against the horizon, to feel the wind whip my hair and blow dust in my eyes, to see the pictures in Aunt Laura's albums, to recreate the memories lost over time. I try to recapture the once vibrant community as I think of the society newspaper clippings that detail a concert performed, a graduation ceremony, a new baby, another wedding, a broken wrist from a horse injury, a visit from an out-of-town guest, all glimpses into a world that was never mine. I regret the loss of this community with hardly enough remaining members to create a centennial memory book. The passage of time has been unkind to Calvin. The harshest blow is evident in the visual remnants of fractured businesses and the loss of the family farms, which for more than 100 years had been so carefully preserved for the next generation. This community survived the challenges of the late 1880s when Indians and buffaloes alike roamed the land. Early pioneers like my ancestors forged a viable and productive life. They left cosmopolitan cities and followed the heeding of the beckoning words, "Go west, young man," and lived in makeshift houses, building and rebuilding after fires, cyclones, tornadoes, and severe winters of 10 to 20 below zero with a wind chill factor of 40 below. Yet these early settlers were strong and fiercely determined to survive. But much as the wind that moves the waves of grain charging across the landscape of the plains, so the cyclones of progress obliterate the small family farms. Tornadoes of opportunity pick up and move the residents further and further from their homes, and the emblems of history are encased in boards that will succumb to the ravages of time. Eventually, my aging cousins, too, drained of energy and spirit, their children and other careers, will relax their hold on the land. I walk around the farm of my grandparents, see the Scottish heather encircling the arbor entrance to the elegantly landscaped yard. The scent of sweet-smelling lavender lilacs is a poignant reminder of my mother. I marvel at the variety of foliage in abundant display, of violet and yellow pansies, of meticulously pruned roses in multicolors of oranges, reds and white, with tall pine trees rimming and separating the backyard from the fields of grain. The richness of the earth nurtures the flowers as well as my soul. I reach down to gather the dirt into my hands. Gradually, I open my fingers and let it sift through to the ground. The past, both lived and imagined, flickers in my mind. My grandmother carefully winds fledgling strands of string beans around the trellis, later to pick the harvest and can them in an all-day arduous process. I remember the smell of homemade bread permeating our home. I see her now as she kneads and shapes the bread into loaves or cinnamon rolls. The aroma of fresh baking bread wafting through the house is a tangible memory. I feel my grandfather's calloused hands and see them tucked into blue denim bib overalls. He is worn. His rugged face reflects the efforts of the day's labor. I remember him telling of the bitter cold winter of 1927 when the temperature dropped to 30 below. I tied a rope from the barn to the house and followed it. The blizzard was so thick I couldn't see my hands in front of my face, and if I stopped moving, I knew I would freeze to death, he told us. We drive the 150 miles from Calvin through Langdon, the birthplace of my father, my siblings, and me, back to Grand Forks. Aunt Laura breaks the quiet occasionally with her scolding. I hear, "They don't have their crops in yet." She shakes her head in disapproval and emits a slight clucking sound. Later, she sees a farm with the wind barrier of trees removed, and again she voices her dismay. "Why do the farmers take them out?" I ask. And she says, "To make more room for crops. Usually the big corporations do it." She tells me a bad windstorm can ruin the planting and devastate the farmer. "The old-timers know better," she says. I ask if the dust storms compared to that of the Dust Bowl, and I hear it wasn't only in Oklahoma. In Grand Forks, the return to my roots encompasses my thoughts. We sit at the dining room table and turn the pages of the albums. Frivolous, haphazard placement of the photos bring the past of my parents and grandparents' lives together with the present time of my children's school pictures sent each year in Christmas cards. The recitations begin, and I hear stories of one-room schoolhouses spotted across the prairie. I hear of the Icelandic couple Aunt Laura lived with as a boarder when she taught in one of those schools, and how at the end of one day it was dark and beginning to snow. Somehow she still needed to walk home. Hearing the tinkling sound of a cow's bell and afraid of getting lost in the blizzard, she held on to the cow that made her way back to the barn. Aunt Laura laughs as she tells this story, pleased with the ingenuity of an independent young girl. She reminds me of the Indians she had in school and how much she loved them, of the artifacts of cooking and grinding bowls buried in the soil, shards of another lost culture. She shares my grandmother's dread, who remembered the 1906 tornado that blew across the Northeast, touching down and picking up an upright piano, whirling it around and returning it in splinters and broken ivory, much like the shattered dreams of fortunes and continuity gleaned from family farms. Tucked into the four black corners, colorless photographs of somber faces stare back at me. I study the arch of the brows, the tip at the end of the nose, the high cheekbones, and am aware of my own resemblance to the ancestors revealed in these scrapbooks. I compare the easy life I live compared to that of my ancestors. Yet I yearn to feel what they felt, to embrace their lives, the land both loved and abhorred, their friend and their enemy, the existence that formed the strength of their characters. The words of President Theodore Roosevelt come to mind when I think of my ancestors. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly." With reluctance, 2 weeks later, I leave my birthplace. I know I will pick up the frantic and sometimes exhausting pace of my life. I will see the rush of humanity, unable to slow down and feel the earth they walk on, to brush the dust from their hands. The land where I live is buried under buildings and houses. It is ironic to me to leave the San Joaquin Valley in California, the breadbasket of the world, and look down from the window of the airplane to see the shrinking agricultural land. I fly to North Dakota, where land is spacious and civilization does not encumber the view. When I arrive back in Fresno, the photos I develop for my own albums enhance my remembrances. Next year, I will return. I will greet my aunt and marvel at her 91 years of life. I will sit with her and hear again the stories of my heritage. The land will radiate with glowing crops, the blazing blue flax, and the cream and golden grains of wheat. The endless wind will howl, and swirls of dust will surround and engulf me. It is then I will know I have come home again.
That was Janice Stevens reading her memoir, Dust to Dust. And even though the author currently lives in the Central Valley, she's a descendant of early pioneers who made their homes up in North Dakota. Every year she goes back there, mainly to the town of Calvin, right near the Canadian border, to once again meet with a few remaining relatives and revisits the memorable sites of her family's history, places like abandoned homes, barns and farms, cemeteries, and a few remaining schools. Her descriptions of North Dakota makes us wonder how those early settlers ever even managed to endure storms, cyclones, fires, wind, dust, and snowstorms. Like the only way to survive a snowstorm is to hang on to a cow who instinctively knows her way back to the barn. And yet, there is a kind of sadness about hearing that the population of that part of our country is diminishing as large corporate farms are buying up most of the landscape. And now we'd like to take a minute to thank both of our talented authors tonight. First, please know that we've had the pleasure of having our first author, Deb Borofka, on our show many times over the past years. We congratulate her on finishing her PhD not too long ago. Also, please know that she was a finalist in the 2009 John Guion Literary Nonfiction Competition, and a story of hers called Remembrance appeared in the Crabtree Orchard Review. Along with her husband, David, the two Borofkas, Deb and David, have been great contributors and supporters of Valley Writers Read, and we thank them ever so much and look forward to more of their stories in the future. We also want to thank Janice Stevens for that excellent story tonight. Friends, Janice not only writes wonderful stories of her own, but takes the time to teach writing to many of our citizens both in Fresno and Clovis, where she conducts classes for both seniors and veterans. Just this year, three of her students sent in stories that were good enough to be accepted on our show, and with the number of talented writers that send us material, that's quite a record. Congratulations, Janice. And so we come to the end of another episode of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Janet Nichols Lynch. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.